Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Fitzpatrick, I understand you have a motion.
Your Honors. I'd like to move the admission of two of Judge Blum's law clerks this morning. Judge Glickstein went to Yale undergraduate and Yale Law School and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Caroline Flynn went to Pomona College and then the University of Michigan for law school and is admitted to practice in the state of California. And we hope, as I always like to say, that we see them back again before this honorable court, both as for paid clients as well as, of course, for pro bono work.
Thank you very much. And hearing no objection, your motion is granted, and we welcome you to the bar of this court. And as Mr. Fitzpatrick said, we hope to see you many times in your future capacities, and we appreciate the work you've done thus far. So you need to turn and take the oath. And
thank you, Your Honors.
Do you solemnly swear that you will demean yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I do.
Congratulations. We are here to hear oral argument in the case of Mark Adonatos against Village of Woodridge. And whenever you're ready, Mr. Burnham.
May it please the court. James Burnham here on behalf of Mr. Mark Adonatos. The ordinance at issue imposes a $30 fee on every person who is arrested by the village police, no matter what. It does so
For a second. Does the repeal of the ordinance have any effect on your case?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. We're seeking money damages, so Mr. Mark Adonatos would like his $30.
But you were asking for an injunction also.
Your Honor, that is both moot, and we've abandoned that request in addition to So, no, the repeal of the ordinance does not affect the case because Mr. Mark Adonatos wants his money back and seeks to represent a class that wants its money back as well. And so, as I was saying, the ordinance imposes the fee for an arbitrary reason and without process. It is therefore unconstitutional on its face.
What does the ordinance mean? So it says when posting bail or bond on any legal process, civil or criminal, or any custodial arrest, including warrant. Does that mean posting bail or bond either on non-arrest legal process or on arrest or in any arrest? Or is that second clause, you know, the after or any, is that completely separate?
Judge Posner, it is not the most artfully drafted ordinance, but our understanding is that how the village applies the ordinance is that
has the ordinance been interpreted ever by a court?
Beyond the federal courts in this case, to my knowledge, Judge Posner.
Well, what if it limits the $30 charge to people who are asking for bail or bond?
I think it would still be
problem. It wouldn't be a problem, would it?
Yes, it would.
Why?
Judge. Because I think that if you had a mandatory fee simply as a condition of posting bond, it would be a different analysis because it would be...
No, I don't understand. So if you want bond, you have to pay for bond anyway. So the town presumably assists you in getting the bond or does some paperwork that's important to the bond, something like that. So it could charge for that, couldn't it?
Judge Posner, I think it would depend on the way the bond system was structured. So in this court's case in Payton against, I believe it was County of Carroll. I'm sorry?
I don't understand. Why don't we know how this is administered?
We don't know how it's administered, Judge Posner, because it hasn't been litigated as a bond case and because Mr. Mark Adonatos didn't pay the fee in order to post bond.
Why does it have to? I don't understand the litigation part of it.
Why don't we there are problems with this record anyway, since it's all 12B6, and we're hearing new information about the ordinance in the briefs of the Village of Woodridge, such as the percentage of time the $30 fee is collected and so forth. But I had thought that the parties agreed and that the village has conceded in its brief on in-bank rehearing that the only thing that's necessary to trigger the $30 obligation is an arrest. And then when the village argues, it's very unlikely that there would be a mistake about that because people know if they've been arrested or not. I take that as a concession that literally the only thing necessary is the arrest.
Yes, Judge Wood, that's exactly right. And in fact,
what if they're wrong? What if this is just some systematic police abuse? That is, what if the ordinance really is limited to cases in which someone asks for bail or bond, which actually would include your client, but the police or the city, village, whatever, they decide, we want that extra $30 anytime someone is arrested.
Oh, Judge Posner,
that's a misinterpretation of the ordinance.
Judge Posner, I do think the ordinance is quite clear that the fee can be imposed solely for arrest because
no,
it has.
No, it's not clear. It's not clear. Because it depends whether you think any custodial arrest, including warrant, goes with any legal process, civil or criminal, or whether you think whether you think when posting bail or bond applies only legal process or also to custodial arrest.
So, Judge Posner, I do think the placement of the commas makes clear that they're talking.
No, it doesn't make clear at all.
I'm not a fan of the Oxford comma myself, but
yeah,
here,
well, forget that. It is not clear. It could easily mean simply that it's for posting bail or bond, whether on any legal process, an arrest, a lawsuit, anything, right?
Judge Posner, I think maybe the more dispositive answer.
I'm just surprised never been interpreted.
But I think that's dispositive. So the village isn't asking for this construction of the ordinance, and they're not.
And it's the village's own ordinance. It's not like it's a state of Illinois law that hasn't been interpreted. It's their ordinance.
Yes, Judge Wood, that's exactly right. And the village has not urged this alternative construction upon the court.
If the village had incorporated, forgive me, I have laryngitis, had incorporated a refund procedure for those whose arrests are quashed, who are not prosecuted, or who are acquitted, would that have solved the problem? Because that's essentially what Naperville eventually did with its fee procedure, as was noted in the Roll case.
So, Judge Robner, I think the answer to your question is yes, though I don't agree that what Naperville has done is what you've described. So rather than get into Naperville, though, I'll just answer your hypothetical. If the ordinance were limited so that people who were not convicted never paid the fee, and there was a process, I guess the process of conviction could supply that process, then we would agree that it would be constitutional. The problem is that the ordinance is neither that limited in terms of who it is applied to, nor does the ordinance supply any process to figure out whether or not the person who is being charged the ordinance, actually committed the crime that they're being charged the ordinance in connection with. And so I think for that reason, the ordinance is facially unconstitutional.
So who else are we dealing with if we're other than arrest quashed, not prosecuted, acquitted?
Well, so Judge Robner, I think there's sort of a spectrum. So there are people who are arrested, and then there are people who are convicted. And I think we can all agree that people who are convicted could be charged the $30. And I would argue that people who have only been arrested certainly cannot be charged the $30. And so where along that spectrum the court draws the line of permissibility, I'm sort of agnostic on because it's not necessary to decide for this case. I think Judge Hamilton's dissent in the panel opinion makes a good point about why probable cause to arrest is problematic.
Wait a second. What about someone who asks for bail or bond?
Judge Posner, I think...
That's a service that the person is asking for. Why can't a fee be charged for the service?
So, Judge Posner, I think that is a much harder...
Separating out the people who are dumped into jail, right, and they don't ask for bail or bond. But the people who ask for bail or bond, like your client, why shouldn't they pay the $30? It's a service, right?
So, Judge Posner, of course, my first answer is that...
If you're innocent and guilty, you would like to get out of jail. So to do that, you want to post bail or bond. So, you pay $30 for that posting. $30 as part of the expense of getting bail or bond.
Certainly, Judge Posner. So my first answer, of course, is that that's not this case. But to answer your question...
Well, wait a second. Why it's not? He did get bail.
Because that's not why the village charged him the fee.
There was a separate fee for bail, wasn't there?
There was. Well, my understanding, and this isn't in the record, is that he paid $150 to get bail.
No, of course not. But the $30 charge, that goes to the...
That was for the arrest.
Someone. Yeah. But right. $30 is... For anyone who posts bail or bond has to pay $30 to the village. Now, isn't that for a service which is assisting in getting the person the bail or bond?
Well, that I think would be the dispositive question. So if you normally under a bail statute, you can put up the entire amount of the bond, like your house, and in which case the village hasn't assisted you in any way. The judge has set a bond amount and you've posted it. The cases that I assume you're implicitly invoking are cases in which you post, let's say, 10% of the bond and the village facilitates that process. And that was the situation in Payton against mm-hmm. County of Carroll. And in that case, I think you're correct to say that you're getting a service from the village because the village is giving you, let's say, a better deal than what the court gave you, and in exchange you pay a fee.
So let me change the subject a little bit, because I am interested in this debate that's going on about the ultimate disposition of Mr. Marco Denotos' case. So he stipulates to some facts or pleads guilty or whatever. He gets supervision. He successfully completes that supervision, and then the charges are dropped, right? So at this point, he stands as if it had been null prost or something, right?
Judge, what I actually think it's even a little worse, I guess, for him than null prost. I mean, he's, in some sense, has admitted a factual basis for guilt. And
right,
we wouldn't,
but the judgment is gone.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the reason I'm asking this isn't so much directly about his present condition, but it's about whether there would be something to talk about in a due process hearing. And I'm wondering whether that is, in fact, such a topic.
Right. So, Judge Wood, we're not asking for a hearing. So we're asking for him to get his $30 back because the ordinance is facially unconstitutional.
All right. So you're not making a procedural due process argument?
Well, that's really the question at the heart of the case, is what is it, procedural due process or substantive due process or just due process that gets to that outcome?
And I thought you were saying, or at least as at the panel level, that one cannot deprive a person of property, such as $30, without providing some form of hearing, pre-deprivation, presumptively post-deprivation, and there's no hearing at any point in time here.
Yes, Judge Wood, that's exactly right, except that I think that's exactly right. And so what we're saying is that the way the ordinance is structured now, you both get no process, and the deprivation is predicated upon, I would say, either a processless decision, the police officer's decision, or an arbitrary reason, depending on how.
And this is critically dependent on the village's interpretation of its own ordinance to have the duty to pay the $30 complete upon the moment of arrest. If everything necessary to need to pay the $30 happens when the police officer decides to arrest you.
That is certainly, yes, yes, Your Honor. And that is exactly how the village administers the ordinance. In fact, my understanding, and again, this isn't in the record, is that when you come to the jail, they take your effects, and they actually will take money from your wallet and hand you the receipt for the arrest, along with your other effects, when they discharge you.
So we're dealing with, you know, with, we are not as far as the bail process.
No, Judge Wood. Here you're not getting any sort of service. I mean, bail, I think, could in some sense be considered
sure.
a benefit that the government
yeah,
is...
Yeah, well, and he got it.
I'm sorry?
And he got that benefit.
Yes.
Suppose the statute didn't refer to custodial arrest. It just said when posting bail or bond in any legal process, civil or criminal, you have to pay the $30. That's what I don't understand why, if that were all that was at stake, there would be any constitutional issue.
Again, Judge Posner, I think, and this would be a question about excessive bail and unconstitutional conditions, in my opinion, rather than due process, because when you're posting bail, you're vindicating your liberty interest in not being detained pre-trial. And all of the bail cases I have seen, with the possible exception of Broussard, the Fifth Circuit's decision, involve a regime in which you are getting a special sort of treatment within the bail process, and you pay a fee for that treatment.
Mr. Burnham, is it also correct to say that in those bail cases, That is a process in which the courts themselves are intimately involved, the courts provide an opportunity to be heard, to have your bail adjusted to your individual circumstances, discretion exercised, and so on.
Oh, absolutely, Judge Hamilton. And in all those cases, too, where they've imposed a bond, there's a law enforcement, a penological interest that motivates the bond. And so that's why the bond has been imposed, and that's why people are either incarcerated pretrial or required to post a lot of money. They're a flight risk, they're dangerous, what have you. Here, there's no law enforcement reason and no law enforcement need to impose the $30 fee on Mr. Marcadonados or anybody else who's arrested.
So you would want some kind of process, meaning like a magistrate or someone, that once someone was arrested, I mean, in terms of not being a violation of procedural due process, you would want someone to intervene, the police officer arrests, someone makes some kind of finding that justifies the arrest or says that the arrest was, you know, met probable cause standards or something like that, and then maybe the $30 would be applicable.
Yes, Judge Williams, generally. I don't agree that probable cause to arrest would be the standard. And I also think the
simplest... And I'm not suggesting that has to be it, but
certainly.
Just throwing it out there.
No, conceptually, I agree. I think the easiest way to solve the problem, though, would be to do what the village does with all of the other fees it imposes on people, and that's just move the time that they impose the fee from arrest to conviction. And, you know, one has to ask themselves, when they look at this ordinance, why did they write it this way? And I think the only...
What do you mean by that? The next fee, towing fee, imposed on an arrestee any time a vehicle release form is required. There's no conviction there.
But there's the towing fee cases involve previous convictions of at least 10 unpaid tickets that became final.
Yes, Judge Wood, I actually don't... that sounds... right to me. I'm not...
You don't know. There's a case that says that.
Yes, Judge Wood, I'm certain that's right. I don't know much about how this towing fee is imposed, Judge Posner.
What about the other fees? This is a municipal ordinance, and your argument about the court costs mixes up the municipal ordinance with state and county fees that are assessable at the end of the criminal process, and I think that's the wrong way to analyze it. This ordinance appears in a fee schedule, basically, that's promulgated by the municipality, and it just says set certain fees for certain things, and there's a whole laundry list of them. Is your argument that all of these are unconstitutional?
Well, Judge Sykes,
there's a hearing?
Well, Judge Sykes, I think it would depend on which fee we're talking about.
Well, what about the release of impounded dog or cat?
Judge Sykes, I don't know, again, how the village administers...
Okay, they make you pay $15 before they release your dog or cat.
Well, presumably, though, Judge Sykes, the person who owns the dog or cat has made some volitional choice that has caused their dog or cat to be impounded. And so you've let your dog run loose, you've let your cat...
Well, right, but they would want a hearing to determine whether they've actually done that thing that caused the dog to be impounded before they have to pay the $15 to get the dog or cat back.
Well, no, Judge Sykes, I don't think so.
Because maybe the police officer just, you know, swooped up the dog from their own property.
Broke into your house and took your dog?
Then I think you could sue for replevin, I suppose. But, I mean, I think, Judge Sykes, I think that...
I'm just asking how far your argument goes. There's a lot of fees that municipalities impose with no hearing.
But aren't any of those fees for service?
So the answer, Judge Sykes, I think, is that the difference between an arrest fee and the lawn cutting fee that the village brings up in its brief or the dog impound fee that you've just suggested is that the service fees really do involve a service that the fee payer has made a volitional choice to bring. So you choose to buy a dog. You choose to have a dog in Woodridge, or you choose to have a lawn, and you choose to let your dog go, or you're negligent, and you let your lawn become overgrown. Arrest is sort of unique in the sense that it's something the government can impose on you for any reason. Well, I mean, not lawfully for any reason, but as a matter of raw power for any reason at any time.
Well, the same argument could be made with respect to all the fees that you've just outlined. There could be an argument made that the fee was wrongly assessed, that the village should not have come in and cut down the noxious weeds, or the village should not have come in and confiscated the dog or cat, or done any of the other things for which municipalities assess routine small fees, the towing fee, the underage vehicle release fee, the vehicle release fee for persons who are not underage. These all depend These are all payable and due and owing without a hearing, and there's no way to get it back.
Judge Sykes, again, I'd have to think about each of them specifically, but with the dog fee, the only situation in which I can think of that fee being unjust would be if the police came into your home and stole your dog from you, in which case the police have committed a criminal act. And so that, I don't think, is something we have to think about when assessing the constitutionality of the fee.
Okay, well, let's talk about the injustice of assessing this fee at all. Separate it out from the procedural question about what process is due. What is unjust about a $30 booking fee?
Well, again, Judge Sykes, I don't know that you can separate out
the... I'm asking you to, because the two questions are really separate. One is a question of substantive due process, and it has to be analyzed separately from the procedural due process question, which is about what process is due. So take the substantive question first. What is fundamentally unfair about this fee on its face, or as applied to certain classes of people?
I think that everyone can agree. I think everyone would agree, and I think the panel majority essentially agreed, and that a fee cannot be imposed for the naked fact of an arrest.
Why not?
Because an arrest can lack probable cause, they can be invidious, there can be all sorts of arrests that are improper.
Why didn't you have, as a member of your, as a named plaintiff, one of these naked arrestees? That would be a much cleaner case than someone who got bond.
Judge Posner, I think...
Now, if we reverse, you'd have to litigate whether the city does actually provide some sort of service when someone asks for a bond. Whereas if you found one of these people who was arrested, you know, and didn't make bond or didn't try for bond, then you'd have a cleaner case. Do you look for such a person? Maybe there is no such person.
We did not look for such a person. I'm not that intimately familiar with all of the people who have been arrested in Woodridge. I think the reason why we didn't get such a person and why we don't need such a person is because the case is completely clean as it stands.
No, it isn't.
Well, respectfully...
Suppose on remand, if we remand it, it turns out that, yes, that whenever someone asks for bail or bond, the people at the police station have to do some paperwork or something.
Well, Judge Posner, again, the village doesn't impose the fee for posting bond, and in fact, there's a receipt that they gave to Mr. Marcadonados, which says nothing about bond. They impose the fee. It says that it was given, he paid the fee in exchange for the service of being arrested. And so I think there's just no question that that's why the
village... How did he get the bond?
My understanding is that he also paid $150 to the police to be released on bond. But that's not in the record, and so I can't say with 100% certainty that's how it happened. But I can say with 100% certainty that they charged him the fee, not because of bond, but because of arrest. And so I think that saying it was imposed because he posted bond would be a lot like saying it was imposed because he pled to supervision, which is just not the case. I mean, that's just not how the village applies its ordinance.
Mr. Burnham, I'd like to take you back to an earlier answer. In one of your answers, you said, at least as I understood you, that your client is not asking for a hearing about this deprivation. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge Easterbrook.
All right. Then you must be making a claim for deprivation of substantive due process. Now, the Supreme Court held in Washington against Glucksberg that there can be no substantive due process claim without deprivation of a fundamental right. The deprivation here is $30. Is it your contention that $30 is a fundamental right?
No, Judge Easterbrook, but I think that the procedural due process, the Supreme Court's and this Court's procedural due process cases make clear that within procedural due process is a prohibition against arbitrary government decision-making. And so one case in particular, I think...
Gee, that just sounds like substantive due process by another name, or maybe you're making a kind of equal protection claim. Usually, if you say a state or municipality has some wacko ordinance that lacks a rational basis, that's an equal protection argument. I don't understand you to be making an equal protection argument.
No, Judge Easterbrook. And so to be clear, when I talk about substantive due process, I'm not talking about the right to privacy or some kind of freestanding.
Yes, what you seem to be doing is talking about substantive due process without a fundamental right. But that would just contradict Washington against Glucksberg.
Well, respectfully,
how does property, I mean, this is really a follow-up, how does property fit into this? I mean, of course Glucksberg is dealing with a different form of interest, liberty interests, but your basing this on property interests, I thought. So why wouldn't $30, is there some de minimis amount of money the government can just take from you?
Of course not, Judge Wood. And I think, look, property is explicit in the due process clause itself. And so I think the thing that is sort of confusing.
No one shall be deprived of property without due process. And usually that means without notice and an opportunity for a hearing. Right? John Hart Ely once described substantive due process as a claim of pastel greenness, pastel pink greenness. The Supreme Court has posed very strict hurdles for turning due process away from process and toward substance. And the biggest hurdle is a fundamental right. That's what seems to be missing here.
So, Judge Easterbrook, if I could direct your attention to the Supreme Court issued a decision in 1981 in Logan against Zimmerman Brush Company. And in that case, a plaintiff had a discrimination claim. And Illinois had a rule that if the state EEOC didn't.
And that was all about process.
Absolutely, Judge Easterbrook, but the Supreme Court's decision depended on the finding that the 120-day, that the state EEOC not meeting its deadline was an arbitrary basis on which to rescind the person's claim. Now, I don't know if that's a procedural or a substantive holding.
Well, it was all about procedure. The plaintiff wanted a hearing.
Well, the plaintiff there, it was a facially constitutional regime with one unconstitutional aspect. That plaintiff wanted an opportunity to vindicate his right to bring a discrimination.
Your view is that a 1981 decision prospectively overrules a 1997 decision of the Supreme Court?
No, of course not, Judge Easterbrook. That was a pure.
Washington against Glucksberg rejected an argument that anything less than a fundamental right would do. The dissent complained. The majority said the dissent was wrong. You're not, as I see it, arguing that there is any fundamental right in $30. You make a mockery of Washington against Glucksberg.
Judge Easterbrook,
that's why I'm so puzzled that you're disclaiming an argument for a hearing.
Well, no, Judge Easterbrook, we certainly want a hearing as well. We just don't want a hearing on whether Mr. Marco Donatos was arrested. I apologize if I was unclear about
that. Well, what would you litigate at the hearing?
I think we would litigate whatever the constitutionally sufficient standard is to deprive someone of property
okay.
and whether it applies
wouldn't
to...
You be litigating?
Under the ordinance, all of that is irrelevant.
Absolutely,
right?
Judge Hamilton. Everything that we're discussing is irrelevant under the ordinance.
Mr. Burnham, is there any other area of law that you're aware of where property is taken based on the unreviewable decision of one government official?
No, of course not, Judge Hamilton.
Finally, and permanently.
No, and I think as this court explained in Johnson against Evanston, what is true of persons is true of property.
And just so why wouldn't you say there's a fundamental right not to have your property just taken by the unreviewable discretion of one officer and get rid of the Washington against Glucksberg problem?
Certainly, Judge Wood. I think there is absolutely a fundamental right to be free from arbitrary governmental action as it relates to property. And that is the fundamental right that we're talking about here. We're not saying that the government cannot take your property, and that's why this is different from the right to privacy or the right to contraception or all the other substantive due process cases that I think were in the forefront of the court's mind in Glucksberg. Here we're talking about the core of the due process clause, which is the right to be free from arbitrary governmental action as it relates to life, liberty, or property. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Redberg.
Thank you. May it please the court. If I just heard counsel correctly, he indicated that they would not be seeking damages on behalf of the plaintiffs, presumably of the class, who are found guilty in the case.
I don't think you heard that.
No, that's not my understanding.
But I want to make it clear that you know the whole subterfuge in the complaint that was brought to this that somehow that there was something improper about the arrest that a hearing would have resolved because after all that's what they were looking for is claiming what the deprivation was is that they were taken the property was taken the money was taken. Without there being an opportunity to contest the facts of the arrest.
So could I
there's
just say
there's
something troubling about these arguments to me, which is what I sometimes refer to as ships passing in the night. If one accepts the idea that this ordinance creates a $30 obligation the minute a police officer walks up to you on the street and says, I'm arresting you, That's one case. You are not arguing that case, really. You're saying, well, actually, when all is said and done, this ordinance requires the $30 only if, after all is said and done, the police were justified in their decision to arrest. And those are two quite different cases. The plaintiffs argue in their briefs, you know, that we even give criminals who eventually are going to be found guilty the right to process. We give them a trial. We do other things for them. So the fact that later on you're going to be guilty doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a due process right. I want to focus on the right to a hearing because I think that's the critical one. But in your brief, you say the only thing that's necessary to trigger this $30 obligation is the arrest itself. And that's when you're discussing the Matthews against Eldridge test, and you say there's virtually no risk of erroneous deprivation because it's going to be obvious if someone's arrested. My problem with that is that if that's all that the ordinance requires, then, you know, all the redheads can be arrested, or the police officer's in a grumpy mood and he goes through the mall and arrests lots of people, or the village decides it needs a boost in its budget and so they get a lot of $30 fees. All kinds of strange things can happen. So I guess I need to know, do you agree that the only thing that's necessary for this fee is the police officer's act of arresting?
The ordinance does use the word arrest in addition to the bonding portion of it, which is at the beginning of the sentence.
Mr. Redberg, the position of the village throughout this case has been that arrest is all that is necessary to trigger the fee, and that's why you have argued so vehemently that the Matthews v. Eldridge test produces nothing to decide, right?
And on page 33 of your brief, you say, under Woodridge's ordinance, the risk of an erroneous deprivation is nil, as the fact of custodial arrest cannot be disputed. The sole question to be determined by the village is whether the individual was subjected to custodial arrest. That question requires a simple yes or no answer that is entirely automatic. So that's why it seems to me what we're trying to decide is whether that kind of ordinance has any problems.
Well, you know, one of
that's
the things
how
that
you described it.
I think there's a little bit of misunderstanding, and perhaps by virtue of plaintiff's argument on this, is that that this is something that just randomly occurs by virtue of a police officer, which is not what is in the facts that are alleged in this complaint.
No, but the ordinance applies to every person who's simply arrested. Maybe some people should be arrested. Maybe other people shouldn't have been arrested. The ordinance, though, doesn't care. The ordinance just says it's $30 the minute the police arrest you.
And, Your Honor, it's custodial arrest. It's not every arrest.
Well, they take you into the station. So they take the person who's standing next to Mr. Margadonatos as well at Target, and they take both of them in. But the person standing next to him, you know, is pure as the driven snow. But he still has to pay the $30.
Okay.
Why do you think that he has to pay the $30 even if he doesn't ask for bail or bond?
Well, part of this is things that aren't really in the record, but part of the reason we brought back to the station is because, and this was a misdemeanor charge, it wasn't a traffic offense, it was a retail theft, is that they have to be brought back to the station to accomplish two things, one of which is to go through the bond procedure, which for misdemeanors is done entirely at the police station.
How does that bond procedure work? What does the person do? Bond.
Well, I can tell you what happened in this case, and again, it wasn't something that was raised by the complaint the plaintiff filed, but Mr. Marquidanis paid cash $120.
I'm asking what the procedure. I know that. They ask questions. What is the procedure?
The procedure is, and this isn't done by a police officer in most cases, it's a community service officer or an administrative clerk who does the paperwork, both on the bond.
Is there a schedule set for a for various offenses that set a particular bond, a preset amount?
I believe that it is state law that determines the procedures for bonds and for making a distinction between misdemeanors and felonies, and depending upon what class the crime fits into. In other words, you have...
So shoplifting is a certain class, and there's a certain amount of bond that has to be posted?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Is it a range or just an amount?
That I don't know, Your Honor.
So what you're saying is there's a bond amount, but you say there's also some paperwork done by the police in connection with that, which is independent of the amount.
Well, as part of the entire procedure, when you're brought back to the station, in addition to the bond, there are things that are required. You have to fingerprint.
No. What is so frustrating to me about this case is neither side discusses the bond aspect of this, right? Now, for most of these people, including the named plaintiff, the person gets a bond and is released. And then the question is that $30 some kind of charge for the paperwork involved in getting the bail or bond, which is different from the actual payment for the bond itself, which is not based on paperwork, but on, you know, risk of flight or what have you. So why don't we know about that? I don't understand it.
But it all involves paperwork, both the bond, both the fingerprinting,
but there's no basis for charging a person for being arrested, even though it costs something to arrest someone, right? That's the problem. I don't see any problem if you just are charging a price for the paperwork involved in getting bond, because that's a service that you provide. A person wants bond. He doesn't want to sit in jail. So the clerk, you know, fills out some form or something, and then he can get his bond and he gets out. I don't see any problem with that.
But
all the talk is about the arrest.
So in interpreting this, I see on the appendix, page 38, the receipt that Mr. Margadonato's gets. And so I suppose the most modest question is, shouldn't we take this receipt as some inkling of what this ordinance is really about? And it says, an administrative fee of $30 is required upon completion of any custodial arrest / booking procedure. And it says, you were arrested on this date, gives this information, and there's a signature. It indicates that they didn't tow his vehicle. So... doesn't this tell us what this ordinance is really doing? It doesn't mention bond here at all. It just says required upon completion of any custodial arrest booking procedure.
It doesn't mention that, but that is part of the entire process.
What if he wouldn't pay the $30? He'll pay the bond, but not the $30. Then what happens to him?
Nothing. As is pointed out in the I mean, the reality you know, the reality is that...
And why are we here?
53, which, and it's not part of the record, but the village, has repealed this ordinance. They're not getting reimbursed for whatever administrative costs they have for the activities, which is what the ordinance addresses.
So then the rest of what it says, fee of 30 days is due 15 days from the date of arrest, is really meaningless?
What does it mean?
I said it's meaningless then. It says fee is due 15 days from the date of arrest.
It's not meaningless in the sense that there is an obligation, but it's an obligation that somewhere around 50% of the people choose not to follow through on, and which is one of the reasons why the village has withdrawn the.
And they talk about, are these the people who don't have the $30 in their wallet?
I don't think there's anything in the record that would support anything that the plaintiff says about supposedly policemen grabbing money out of the wall.
You all move for dismissal under 12b-6, right?
Pardon?
You all move for dismissal under 12b-6. That's the procedural posture we're in, right?
We did.
Okay.
But, you know, this isn't just a like a random arrest. I mean, this is an arrest that was made based upon a complaint signed by somebody at the store.
Does any of that matter under the ordinance?
Where in the ordinance does it say that matters? Where in the ordinance does it say that the good ones?
It doesn't say that, Your Honor.
Could I ask you, yeah. Counsel? I'd like you to address a point that was raised in the plaintiff's brief. Your constitutional logic, as I understand it, would seem to allow the police to charge a user fee for conducting a traffic stop, for doing a breathalyzer test, for doing DNA tests, perhaps for carrying out a search warrant. Is that right?
Well, that's what the plaintiff says.
That's
certainly not the position. That's not the position that we have taken.
Give me a rational constitutional distinction that would separate those.
Because I think there you're talking about imposing fees for a penalty, a criminal penalty, which is not the case here.
Just for conducting a traffic stop. A traffic stop that results in the issuance of no ticket. But it takes a police officer's time. He may have to run some computer checks and so on. A breathalyzer test obviously has expenses, even if it shows that there's no illegal level of alcohol, right? Why don't you charge fees for those? Why can't you charge fees for those if you can charge a fee for an arrest?
You're talking about policemen on the street. You're talking about other people during the service. You know, these are administrative services. These are administrative as opposed to basic police functions.
So you could do a traffic. You could charge a fee for a traffic stop.
No, I don't believe you could.
Why not?
Huh?
Why not?
I mean, it's not. There's not. That's what policemen do. That's not the. You know, that's not the additional work
and
that's
police
required
officers
because you have
arrest
to bring
somebody
people. Back to the station.
Police officers arrest people. Right?
See, what you should have argued was that the part of this booking fee provision that says any custodial arrest is unconstitutional and unenforceable, and that the legitimate part of the booking fee is the $30 for someone who's asking for bail, like Marco Donatos, right? Then there'd be no case.
Well, I'll take your advice next time on that, Your Honor.
Well, the appeal, right? It's all history.
But, Your Honor, in answer to that, when you're talking about 12b-6, you're kind of stuck on the allegations of the complaint. And, so that if you try to confine yourself to the issues that are raised in the complaint.
You could have acknowledged in your answer that, no, you can't just impose a charge for someone for being arrested. Well, thank you. I was arrested. I'm delighted to pay this modest fee for having been arrested, saving me from doing worse crimes, right? Okay. That's ridiculous. So forget about that. And you're left with all these other fees, which actually are fees for doing something which could benefit the person who pays the fee, like getting his impounded cat back, right?
For instance, the towing fee, when you're talking about a benefit, people don't think they're getting a service by virtue of having to pay a fee for the towing of their vehicle.
If I'm arrested and my choice is being in jail and getting bond, I'd much rather have bond. And if, there's some expense to the police station to arrange for my bond, then they can charge me a $30 fee. That's a service, right?
But the towing involves different...
The statute addresses activities. This is an activity. And they may not want the activity.
What, your activity of being arrested?
Mr. Redberg,
the activity is what the clerks or the CSOs are having to perform because this person has been brought into the station and is being bonded out and booked for the crime.
Mr. Redberg, let me ask you one more question, if I could.
Sure.
About as I understand it, the village of Woodridge requires businesses to be licensed, correct?
I'm sure they do, yes.
And there are provisions and procedures for suspending or revoking licenses, right?
Yes.
Suppose the village modified those ordinances to say that when the city initiates a proceeding to suspend or terminate a business license, that the license holder has to then pay a fee of $1,000 to offset the costs of the process. Would that be constitutional under your view?
I'm not uncertain that they can't charge fees in connection
to start the proceeding.
Suppose the federal government imposes a fee of $450 just to file a lawsuit in district court. Do you think that would be valid?
Then suppose the federal government charged defendants a filing fee to appear to defend yourself. That's the comparison. You're the defendant in something that has been launched against you. Can you be charged a fee at the beginning for that?
Defendants in the civil cases are charged fees all the time. For
initial
something
filing
that you don't
fees?
Want to do.
For
you
what?
Don't want to have to respond to a lawsuit.
For
you're
what?
Charged a fee.
For what?
There are appearance fees. There's jury demand fees. But just for the privilege of appearing in a case, you have to pay a fee. There's all kinds of fees. And what astounds me about this case is that the complaint.
But an arrest is not a privilege. Paying for being arrested. It's ridiculous, really.
Well, it's not exactly a privilege that you have
exactly
when you come into court to defend a lawsuit.
Approximately a privilege?
Where someone's trying to take your money away. There's fees all over, and it astounds me that we have this plaintiff who's complaining, and we haven't even reached the issue of standing at all, but this plaintiff is complaining about this modest $30 administrative charge.
Yeah, but
in fact, he ends up paying $765 based upon his agreement to stipulate to the facts that he stole the merchandise.
I heard you say a little bit ago that this was not a criminal penalty. Did I not? Somewhere along the way there.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But isn't it a criminal penalty in the sense that it's tied to what the police officer believes is criminal conduct? I mean, that is what triggers the arrest, the police officer's belief that this person is committing a crime.
They believe that there's probable cause for the commission of a crime, which in this case, I don't think there's any question that there is probable cause.
Although the interesting thing about this case is how does this ordinance apply to this particular kind of disposition under Illinois law? And if you success, I mean, we normally deal in court judgments, not in the underlying process that gets to the judgment. And at the end of the day, he successfully serves his supervision, and one wonders if that would entitle a person to a refund of the $30 in a post-deprivation sense. I don't know. I mean, this is not as clean a case for you as if he had been caught selling 5 grams of cocaine. He serves his time in prison. He's out, and he was complaining about the arrest for selling a little bit of cocaine. That would be a cleaner case from your standpoint, I think, than this one is.
This is not a case where, as plaintiff claims, that he's found not guilty.
Well, but
this
I'm
is,
looking
is
at
a
the
guilty
Illinois
plea
statute.
In this.
Illinois Code 730. 5/5-6-3.1 says in Part E, and this is what happened to him, at the conclusion of the period of supervision, if he's complied with everything, the court shall discharge the defendant and enter a judgment dismissing the charges, and then it goes on in subpart F, saying that this kind of discharge and dismissal shall be deemed without adjudication of guilt and shall not be termed a conviction for purposes of disqualification or disabilities and so on. So I don't know how it would come out. I'm just saying there's a legal issue about this circumstance, and he's not as clearly guilty or as clearly not guilty as some people might be.
I think you're talking about the disposition of the conviction as opposed to what the plea was.
Well, the ultimate judgment is what I'm talking about, the ultimate judgment.
There was a finding, and the document's in there, is there was a finding of guilty in this case.
I know it.
There's a plea of guilty and a finding of guilty, and it's a disposition that's allowed by Illinois law, but only upon completion of the conditions. It goes more to the sentence as opposed to it being absolving a person for their criminal conduct.
But what the statute talks about is the judgment, not a conviction, not the underlying evidence, not the sentence. And my only point, it's a small point, is that this is an intermediate case. It's not either clearly somebody's nice grandmother who's picked up, you know, at the shopping mall, or, you know, with for no reason, or the cocaine person who was adjudicated guilty is guilty. That'll be on his record forever. It's somewhere in between, and I think that's somewhat interesting when you're talking about whether a hearing would be of any use. I think it goes to the standing issue.
Well, the question is, when you talk about the hearing, I think the case is valid that due process does not require process merely for the sake of process.
Of course.
Under the facts of this case.
And I'm saying, under the facts of this case, it doesn't strike me it would necessarily be a hearing just for the sake of a hearing.
Well,
and besides, we have hearings just for the sake of hearings all the time. They're called, you know, misdemeanor proceedings in court. They're called trials. We have them even though the police are really sure that somebody's guilty.
Well, this is not the guilty plea. It's not
does
the plea made by the policeman.
Woodridge,
it's made by the
does
by the plaintiff
Woodridge,
in this case.
Refund the $30 if the person is exonerated?
And I missed the first part of your question.
Does Woodridge refund the $30 if the person arrested is exonerated?
I don't know that anyone's ever asked, but under the ordinance, they do not have the obligation to refund it, in answer to your question.
That proper?
As a practical matter, you know, I don't know.
Mr. Edberg, could you return to an earlier inquiry about a person who's arrested and there is no subsequent bond or bail sought? Person's arrested, brought to the station, custodial arrest, and process proceeds. In other words, goes to the hearing before the associate judge or whatever is the appropriate judicial figure. What happens in that case?
Oh, okay. Well, that they're not brought to the station, and I think what you're talking about is
now
kind
you're
of
arrested. What happens factually after the arrest in the village?
Well, I'll tell you. If you have someone arrested on the street, say it's a traffic offense, doing 30 in a 20-mile-an-hour
driving under the influence. So you have to be taken in. You can't move your vehicle, right? So you're placed in the squad car and you go to the station, but you don't seek bond. What happens then?
Well, if you don't seek bond,
right?
Then you're going to be detained,
right?
$30.
That's my inquiry.
And then later on you will be brought to court on it,
right?
Are you liable for the $30? The person who Judge Flom is hypothesizing, they DUI, they're taken to the station, they don't even ask for bond. Do they have the $30 fee assessed against them?
Yeah, the alleged drunk driver would be responsible for the $30 fee that's imposed.
But if he doesn't pay, it doesn't make any difference. Are you
pardon?
But if he doesn't pay, it doesn't make any difference. Right.
Well, that's a matter of collection, a matter of practicalities.
But after 15 days of
you don't have any method of collecting.
After 15 days, it may go to a collection agency. But the thing, because things go out for collection in the real world, a lot of people don't pay.
But
particularly
you said
50%
of them are collected, right? Roughly 50% of these.
So somewhere in that vicinity, and it's I'm not going to say we have exact numbers on it, but that's, you know, that's the approximate percentage.
So you seem to take great comfort in the fact that the fee is only $30. So if the fee was $300, would somebody be entitled to a hearing or some process?
Well, you know, at some point, and I don't know exactly where that point is that, yes, I would think that. But, you know, if you use the Eldridge
factor. Because $30 means different things to different people. For someone who's unemployed or out of work, $30 could mean a lot of money. It, to someone else, $300 could be peanuts in terms of what they. So, but you think it's tied to the financial amount, whether or not someone is entitled to some process?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say that. I think Judge Hamilton, or, you know, in one of the briefs, in the order, was talking about if it's $1,000. Well, that might be a little bit different case. But that goes back to the Matthews versus Eldridge. And when you're talking about the first requirement of it, what is the what is the interest of the plaintiff, of the person involved? And, you know, is there a difference between $30 and $1,000? Yes, there is. But it's a minimal interest, and we don't have any allegations in this complaint.
Those $30 add up for the municipality, and so. I mean, what's to say that other municipalities can't do the same thing? They got low revenue coming in, and so this is a great way to make money.
Well, given our rate of return on it, I wouldn't say it's necessarily
a great
return, on the money. But the thing is, you know, I think it's permissible under the law. I mean, in this case, if we had a hearing, which would entail getting an administrative judge and all kinds of expense on the village.
Why would it have to do that for the misdemeanor cases? Why couldn't you just fold it into the hearing on the merits of the shoplifting charge? I'm not following why it requires a whole new layer of hearings.
And I think that requires state law that would authorize municipalities to charge the fees. The state laws allow the court to impose fees, which are part of the $700 and some odd that this gentleman paid. But I don't know that they necessarily have the statutory authority to do that. They do have authority under Illinois law to charge a fee for the processing of the bond.
That's the problem here. You have an impaired statute. If the statute had read that when you're posting the bond after, not at an or, we wouldn't have the problem. But you have a situation, whether it's either the bond or a no bond situation. So that the simple arrest, that's what I raised with you, the simple arrest causes a charge for an administrative fee of taking the officer, I guess, off the roadways and into the station house.
And involving other people in the process.
Well,
not just
I understand that. That's the nature of custodial involvement. So that your position is the simple arrest, put bond aside under this statute, causes a payment of a fee. You could make this fee $500. Let's not talk about the minimus amount. Whether it's $5 or $500, isn't it your position that taken off the street, taken to the station, and just accepting the process that comes to you, not seeking bond, the village could charge $500.
But that's not the case here, Judge.
I'm talking about the statute.
We're talking about apples and oranges here.
Well, because it's $30 rather than $500?
Yes, it's a de minimis amount, and I understand that to some people it may be a larger amount, but in terms of society today, and in terms of what courts charge and what fees are assessed and that sort of thing, it is a very small amount. And the case we have before us, we don't have any allegation that Mr. Mercadonis is indigent or anything like that. That's not before us. That's not the case here.
Your time is up, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Burnham?
I
Just a few quick points, Judge Wood. To be clear, we paid the $30, and nobody told Mr. Marcadonatos that he didn't actually have to pay it. So
he also made a judicial admission of guilt and didn't offer any challenge to the validity of the arrest. So I question his standing to raise the argument about the substance of the statute.
Judge Sykes, I'm glad you asked that question because we didn't get to talk about standing that much when I was up here last time. I think under the terms of the ordinance, the fee is imposed without process for an arbitrary reason, solely
right,
because...
Right, but your constitutional argument as a substantive matter, setting aside the procedural issue, your substantive constitutional argument only challenges one aspect of the statute, and that is how it applies to people who actually have an argument that they've been arrested invalidly or wrongfully. And that's not him. He made a judicial admission that cannot be retracted and has not been wiped off the books by this unusual procedure.
No, Judge Sykes, it's not. So I think
What is the hearing going to accomplish? The remedy for this sort of a violation is ordinarily more process. And you initially said he didn't want process. He wanted his money back. But he doesn't get his money back because on his argument, he would have had to pay this fee anyway.
Well, he wants both, but let me give you a hypothetical that I think makes my conceptual point. Imagine that the ordinance said redheads pay $20 on Tuesday. The village couldn't come in to, if Mr. Marcadonatos was a redhead, I don't know if he's a redhead, but he's Greek, so he's probably not a redhead. But if they had come in and said, well, Mr. Marcadonatos robbed a bank on Monday, and we can charge him a $20 fee for robbing the bank because he got convicted of the bank robbery, that wouldn't deprive him of standing to challenge the fact that they actually imposed the fee because he was a redhead. And so here, I completely agree with you, Judge Sykes. Had they charged the ordinance because he pled to supervision, that would be okay. But they didn't. They charged the fee solely because he was arrested, not because he posted bond, not for any other reason. And I think that is why.
Right, but you're only.
Is your position, Mr. Burnham, that his claim was ripe as soon as he paid it, regardless of the later outcome?
Absolutely, Judge Hamilton. And that's why everyone has the exact same claim. He could have been John Hinckley. Everyone knows John Hinckley was guilty. But you still couldn't have charged John Hinckley a fee for being arrested, just like you couldn't have locked him up forever solely because if he was arrested.
It's a question of who's the proper plaintiff, not whether the claim is ripe. And who is the proper plaintiff to make the argument that you wish to make, which, as a substantive matter, again, not as a process matter, as a substantive matter, as applied to this subset of people, this ordinance may be substantively unreasonable or irrational or whatever substantive due process test you want to apply. But that's not him. He's not in that group of people.
Judge Sykes, respectfully, it is unconstitutional as applied to anyone because it is never constitutionally permissible for the government to take property solely because you were arrested.
Why?
Oh, is this not?
Because arrest is not a constitutionally sufficient...
That subsumes the substantive question.
So are you making the argument essentially that guilty or not guilty ultimately, as it were, the extra $30 is not something that can be imposed... it's an extra $30 for the people like Mr. Marcadonatos who confesses to the facts underlying the charge. It's the first $30 for the old grandmother. But your argument has to be that even criminals don't have to pay unjustified exactions.
Certainly, Judge Wood. And had the village linked the fee, which they certainly could have done, to conviction, all you'd have to do is add upon conviction to the
ordinance. Right. That's your different ordinance that we don't have.
That's correct, Judge Wood.
What if they limited it to cases in which some people were seeking bond?
So just yes, absolutely. So I think you have to ask yourself why.
Why didn't you find some? I don't understand. You're a class action lawyer, I take it. Why didn't you advertise for named plaintiffs? Why not find someone who didn't have?
Judge Posner,
it's a cleaner suit.
The reason why is because the village has always applied this, irrespective of bond. And I think the reason they've done that,
and of course that means that look. They arrest hundreds of people every year. I'm sure many of those arrests are improper, and therefore it should be easy to find people whose rights have clearly been violated because they didn't receive any service in exchange for their $30.
Respectfully, Judge Posner, it's because I just don't think it matters. And the reason I don't think the court should give the village the benefit of a savings construction it has never asked for and that it has never applied. It wrote the ordinance as broadly as it could to impose the fee on as many people as it could. It wanted to get the people that don't post bond and the people who do and the people who are innocent and the people who are guilty. And I don't think the court should carve out a Mr. Marcadonato specific definition to save the village from its own overbroad and arbitrary ordinance. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement. The court will stand in recess.